What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Macy Hart, the Executive Director of the Institute of Southern Jewish Life. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. What will Judaism be like in America in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years? That's the crystal ball question that the American Jewish community asks itself on a pretty constant basis, and more so these days than ever before. We live in a mobile society in which traditional allegiances can no longer be assured, where things trend and disappear faster than ever, where millennials and others are less likely to join or commit to long-term relationships with people, organizations, or religious affiliations. What does all that mean for a 3,800-year-old faith? What are the trends and changes we can expect to see in Jewish life in this country where we are so broadly accepted that assimilation may have become an inevitability? We Jews have thrived in the United States and have created many Jewish institutions that are successful and well-established. In fact, you can easily make the case that the American Jewish community of the 20th and 21st century is the most integrated and successful community in our nearly 4,000 years of history, with perhaps the sole exception of Israel today or the ancient Judean and Israelite states in Israel long ago. Jews are at the pinnacle of achievement in almost every area of American life. There are Jews in the Senate, the House, on the Supreme Court, really everywhere in our national life. But the truth is that all the wonderful Jewish institutions we have founded in this golden land of opportunity, and which have long flourished, are in some trouble these days, because without a vibrant Jewish community that remains committed to their perpetuation and development, they will clearly not be so vibrant in the coming decades, and many of them may not survive at all. There's always an inherent tension in non-Orthodox religions between tradition and change, and this is particularly true here in America, a land of seemingly perpetual and often dynamic change. If you are Orthodox, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, really any kind of orthodoxy, you may be troubled by the changes in society going on around you. But the inherent structure of your religious experience and the allegiances and commitments that you adhere to are not so likely to be swayed by societal turmoil. It is the nature of orthodoxy to stay mostly the same. But if your religious tradition is more connected to contemporary life, and if you believe that your way of expressing your own beliefs should be contemporary too, then you are continually engaged with an ever-changing world, and the pace of that change seems to be accelerating. This is both a wonderful opportunity and a continuous challenge. On the one hand, you have the chance to embrace new ideas, new music, new ways to seek God, new ways of learning. It keeps you fresh and energized, and you can discover that no 2 days are the same. On the other hand, your own commitment to that tradition is constantly stretched and even challenged. In what ways should your religious tradition change? In what areas should it remain constant? What insights can you bring to the new issues and ideas at play in the world? This situation is doubly true for religious leaders, you know, like rabbis. In an America of constant dynamic change, how can we reshape what we do to reach a changing constituency without alienating the people we already have? That's what makes contemporary Reform Judaism so interesting today and so challenging. We Reform Jews have to be both dynamic and traditional, diverse but also deep. And simultaneously, we need to find ways to reach a population that seems both more fickle than ever and less focused on experiencing actual Judaism than previous generations. And we need to find a way to do this without losing sight of the great depth of Jewish learning, ethics, and spiritual inspiration. There's an old saying, Schwerz ist ein Jid. That means it's hard to be a Jew. In the old country, even in the old days here in America, that meant there was a high level of persecution or discrimination or both. It's hard to be a Jew, however, in a very different way these days. While in most ways here in America it's easier to be Jewish than it ever has been, in another sense it's harder to find ways that we can guarantee Jewish connection and commitment to the remarkable experience of being a Jew in a free land. So, speaking of freedom, Pesach is coming up fast. And so, to get us all ready for the coming festival of Matzah and Freedom, not in that order, here's our pre-Passover preview of Pesach song from the classic Moroccan Israeli singer Yehoram Gaon, Kadesh Urchatz, the Semen LeSeder Shel Pesach, the order of the ritual meal itself, the Passover Seder. Kadesh Urchatz, Ekare Paseyachatz, Magid Rachetza, Motzi Matza. Maharor Ekorech, Shulecha Neorech, Tzafun Barech, Halel Niretza. Kadesh urechatz, ekare paseyachatz, magid rachetza, motzi matza. That was Yehoram Gaon singing the order for the Passover Seder. Pesach begins April 3rd. Stock up on your matzah. Before we get to Passover, however, it's appropriate to celebrate all the other kinds of Jewish food, most of which we won't be able to eat when we finally get to Pesach. Here is a mostly forgotten classic from the late, great Alan Sherman called There Is Nothing Like a Lox.
We got herring sweet and sour. We got pickles old and young. We got corned beef and salami and a lot of tasty tongue. We got Philadelphia cream cheese in a little wooden box. What ain't we got?
We ain't got lox.
We got coleslaw freshly made and chopped liver also fresh and a lot of things to please a man whose name is Moish or Hesh. We got plenty pumpernickel, we got bagels hard as rocks. What ain't we got?
We ain't got lox.
We got plenty of every food which is known as kosher, with the possible exception of smoked salmon, which is occasionally referred to by the upper classes as Nova Scotia.
There is nothing like a lox, nothing in this world.
Wrapped in paper or a box, that is anything like a lox. Men who manufacture frocks, they go wild for lox. Men who speculate in stocks are investing their stocks in lox. There is no fish like a lox, no other dish like a lox, and nothing smells like a lox or repels like a lox. There's nothing smart like a lox that burns the heart like a lox. There ain't a thing that's wrong with any man here that can't be cured by putting him near a salty, pinkish, slightly stinkish lox.
That was the inimitable, wonderful Alan Sherman singing There's Nothing Like a Lox. There's never been anything like him either, and I don't think there ever again will be. Jews live in every part of America, and we've been well represented in every region of this great country, but the Jewish community of the American South is unique and particularly interesting. Having served the Southern Jewish community for 4 years as rabbi early in my career in Spartanburg, South Carolina, I can tell you that Southern Jews are special. They are deeply committed to their Jewish religion and heritage. They are polite and courtly in a way no other Jews really are. They have the best accents, and they have a rich history and culture that are unlike that of any other region. And Macy Hart, the man who knows more about Southern Jewry and has done more to preserve that great culture, will be here in a few moments to talk about it on Too Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquagaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Macy Hart is the president and CEO, the founder and inspirational spirit and genius of the Goldring-Woldenberg Institute of Southern Jewish Life, which promotes Judaism and Jewish heritage through a variety of innovative programs and resources, particularly in the South. I want to just ask you, Macy, you know, what you have created there is a unique institution that has done something for an important Jewish community that I'm not sure it's ever been done anywhere in the world. What gave you the idea to start the Institute of Southern Jewish Life?
The need is out there, and it's so prevalent, and we were, as a Jewish community, movements and agencies, basically dealing with a constituency we really didn't know.
Now, you're from the South, and when we spoke before this interview, you said the reason that it became the Institute of Southern Jewish Life and that you extended your reach in that region is just because it was familiar to you. But isn't there something more to it than that?
Well, I actually believed all of the things I learned in high school as I got involved in the regional and then the national youth movement of the Reform Movement. I believed all the stuff about making a difference, and I just saw the Jewish community languishing from underservice and neglect, and yet they had done all the things they needed to do in the earlier years to try to promote Jewish life. So that's it. I wanted to see if we could make an absolute change in the way we do a number of things to bring Jewish life to the country.
So among the changes, I think you started by preserving some of the physical aspects, the beautiful arcs and other elements in Jewish communities that were really no longer active and vibrant. It's gone a long way from there. Talk about that first, you know, kind of preservationist aspect of it.
Well, as the camp director of a four-state area, the Henry S. Jacobs Camp, started collecting Judaica from congregations that had either moved and had Judaica hanging out or Judaica that was bought in flea markets. So I thought we should put a stop to that, and quote, stuff started showing up at the camp, stuff left on my desk with no attribution or factual information, and we had to track down even who left it. And so in 1986, founded the Museum of the Southern Jewish Experience. In 89, we opened a building that was a slash museum synagogue, so that we could preserve the whole legacy of L'dor V'dor. And our kids got a chance to worship in front of an ark that was built in 1865, the first we think the first synagogue built after the war between the states,
or as they called it when I was in South Carolina, the War of Northern Aggression.
Well, I couldn't go to that part.
I appreciate that.
I was actually hoping that 2011 to 2015 would be the time when we returned to civility, and that the Civil War would be put to a close because we all learned how to treat each other. That was my hope. But so far, it hasn't happened.
As we say, Beviat HaMashiach, when the Messiah comes, maybe before the Messiah. We will talk much more with Macy Hart, the president and really the spirit of the Institute of Southern Jewish Life, about that and much more when we come back in just a few moments on Too Jewish. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it, is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website by streaming them from there, or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mevinan Israel, Oshrat Bariel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So, finally, the Israeli elections are around the corner. Let's talk about how a government gets formed in Israel, because the elections are really just the starting point. Then you know the distribution of parties in the Knesset, and the president chooses the head of the largest, usually the largest, not always, the party with the largest number of seats to try to form a government. So then what happens after that? Because that's where it's so different from the United States.
Yeah, and usually all these arrangements starts even before the election.
They've got deals.
They have condition. Like Shas will say, we will go with you, Bibi.
We'll bring our 13 seats if you give
and
us...
And if you'll give us the welfare, the ministry
education,
of...
Education, ministry.
Sure. Mostly the welfare and the ministry of the Dator, the religion. And if you will agree not to push the Giuse Chayalim, the draft law.
If you won't push the yeshiva deferments, if you'll leave those off the table.
So there is all kind of, you know, deals before the elections. And then some of the government, it's not the last one, also the last one, but I think this just one before the last one was very, very surprising. Like how would some parties will sit together if they think like totally completely the opposite.
Well, I think even this government, you know, we had three parties involved, the three largest parties in this government.
Yeah.
Likud, which is Netanyahu's party, the traditional right wing.
Yeah, Likud was with Israel Beitenu.
So right, Israel Beitenu, which is the Israel Home Party, which is a modern Orthodox kind of settler-oriented party. And then Yair Lapid, who brought his centrist party, which is a middle-class party with economic interests, and somehow these three parties, who seem to have nothing in common, were sitting in, they were the government. This is like the left wing of the Democratic Party forming a government with the Tea Party in America. Like, it doesn't make any sense to us. How do they do this?
That's why it not lasts so much, I think.
That's why it doesn't work so
well. Yeah, it doesn't work. Because they don't have like a solid common ground, like, you know, things that they would
ideologically
believe, and then they would put every effort in order to promote it. That's the huge problem. And I think the huge problem that we talked about it like a few weeks ago, that when it used to be 40, 42 seats for each, like for the big
parties, it was easy to have
a very like a coalition of 70 or 80, which make the government and the prime minister easy life to
and also he can
promote,
and he can also take some chances if he has a strong coalition.
Yeah. Just try to imagine how we will, if the coalition will include Chas and some of the social, you know,
new parties
and the Likud, how, for God's sake, he will be able to promote the negotiation with the Palestinians.
He won't have any strength behind him because they all pull different directions. Well, we hope it comes out coherent, and this needs to be put in the hands of God, I'm afraid.
Let's pray.
We will pray. Thanks, Sashra.
We will
talk next week.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Gero Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
In preparation for Passover, our Jewish poetry slam this morning is on perhaps the most elemental part of the Pesach Seder, the often overlooked bowl of salt water on the table. This is from Marge Piercy's Passover series, a poem of that name, Saltwater. It is a bowl of tears on the table into which we dip the parsley, into which we dip the egg. It is a miniature ocean on the table, salt as the sea of reeds through which they were to pass. Not to safety, never safety, but to where they were promised they would, if they chose, be free. It is the salt water of our sweat, pressed through our skin as the body labors, for we are bidden not only to rest on the seventh day, but to work on the others, and the brain too in its fever of creation exudes. Salt like the sea, salt like our blood, salt like the waters of the womb, the salt of regret, and the salt of effort. That was Marge Piercy's fine poem for the Seder table called Saltwater. First Seder is April 3rd. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, we began exploring the sources of anti-Semitism in the world historically. We talked about the Greeks. After all, in a way, Hanukkah was sort of a victory against anti-Semitic decrees in an attempt to eliminate Judaism. But it obviously doesn't stop in the Greek period.
Right.
Let's move forward a little bit.
Well, so if we move forward in the Mediterranean world, which is where most Jews lived in those centuries, although there were still Jews left in Persia and Babylonia, modern Iran and Iraq, from the destruction of the First Temple.
Probably some in India, some in Africa, but really most were still in those Mediterranean area.
So the next great power in the Mediterranean world, which sort of took over from the Greeks and pushed them out of power, although not out of cultural and intellectual influence, was the Romans. And the Romans gradually took over from the Greeks well before the beginning of the Common Era, well before the life of Jesus, well before the birth of Christianity. And the Romans had their own issues with the Jews. I think one maybe constant factor throughout time is just how different Jews are from everybody else. And in those centuries, everybody else was a polytheist. Only Jews were monotheists. And apart from that kind of doctrinal difference, there were differences in practice. There were differences in calendar. There was the fact that the Jews circumcised their sons, and both the Greeks and the Romans regarded this as an abomination, a crime against humanity, because the perfect expression of beauty was the young athletic male body. Look at all those statues from the Greeks and the Romans. And they considered the Jews to be systematically defacing the greatest expression of beauty in the world. Jews were reluctant to participate in athletic games naked, which was the custom among Greeks and Romans. Jews had a set of dietary laws which made it difficult, if not completely impossible, for them to eat, drink, and be merry with their non-Jewish neighbors. So their separateness was interpreted often as a sign that they thought of themselves as better than anyone else, that they were aloof and superior and snotty. So all of this was resented by the Romans to a surprisingly large degree, and that generated a certain degree of anti-Semitism and even anti-Jewish violence in the pre-Christian world. And then, of course, with the birth of Christianity, things began to change in very significant ways, first in the Roman world, and then as Christianity spread beyond the borders of the Roman world throughout the ancient world.
Yeah, you know, we can talk about that next week, but I want to note that there are some really remarkable Roman tractates that were published as early as 1st century BCE and certainly in the 1st century CE that talk about how the Jews are the laziest people on earth because they take a day off every week. They didn't understand this Shabbat concept. And not only do they take a day off, they give their wives and their children the day off. And this is how crazy they are. They give their servants and their animals the day off. You know, like this was anathema to the Romans. So when you think
about
crime
against humanity.
Crime against humanity, indeed. We will continue to explore this next week. Thanks,
Tom. I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Hi, I'm Ben. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help provide a Jewish education to families at no cost to you by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. You can help make Jewish education affordable.
Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K through 8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you give to JETCO, you get 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income taxes are reduced by the exact amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,053 for a single filer or $2,106 for a married couple filing jointly and get that whole amount back from state income tax.
Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442. Or you can go to JETCO.org.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A grandson is asking his wealthy old Zadie, Morris, how he made his money. Morris fingers his waistcoat and says, "Well, son, it was 1933, the depth of the Great Depression. I was down to my last nickel. So I invested that nickel in an apple. I spent the whole day polishing the apple, and at the end of the day, I sold that apple for 10 cents. Next morning, I invested those 10 cents in two apples. I spent the entire day polishing them and sold them at 5 p.m. for 20 cents. I continued this system for a month, by the end of which I'd accumulated the sum of $1.60. What happened then, Zadie?" the grandson asks. "And then my wife's Uncle Bernie died and left us $2 million. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin the middle book of the Torah, Leviticus. The Hebrew name for the book comes from its first word, Vayikra, God called. There's a famous idiosyncrasy about the Aleph, the last Hebrew letter in the word Vayikra as it's written in the Torah, because it is written smaller than the other letters in the word. Aleph, the Midrash tells us, is the first letter of the word Ani, I. Therefore, if we wish God to call us directly, we must diminish our focus on I and seek to limit our egotism. If we can do that, then we, like Moses, will be able to clearly hear God's call, to respond, and so to find the holiness that makes up the central subject of the book of Leviticus. Less of the I, and so more of God. A very nice interpretation indeed. But there's something rather puzzling about this midrash as well. If Moses, our greatest leader, was truly the humblest man in the world, as the Torah says, just how did he have the ego strength to lead an enormously fractious group of Jews across the wilderness to the promised land, often seemingly against their will? How could anyone who was so humble and modest manage to lead such a people through all the trials and tribulations described in the Torah? Perhaps the secret lies in the inner strength that comes only from faith. Faced with the vicissitudes of life and the challenges and demands of a world that is far from completion and wholeness, our own arrogance cannot carry us to any promised land we seek. But trust in a God who implants within each of us a spark of the divine, a core element of holiness that we can draw upon at times of crisis, well, that can carry us to a better place. Moses realized that he himself was really unfit for the task that God had assigned him, and so he was indeed humble. But he also knew that the God he believed in, and whose mitzvot he followed, was infinitely powerful and profoundly holy. If he, Moses, a fallible human being, simply placed his confidence and trust in God, he would ultimately succeed. So too for us. We can't really do it alone, however we define it. But if we place our faith in God and know that God can and will help, we may become like Moses, humble but holy. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest Macy Hart will explain how vital Judaism remains in the American South and what it can teach us about being Jewish everywhere in 21st century America. Find out when we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... At Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson, take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from our guest, Rabbi Batsheva Appel.
With elections in Israel only a few days away, prospects are not looking as rosy for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as they were when he called for elections in December. Current polling gives the Zionist Union Party a 4-seat advantage over Netanyahu's Likud party. In the past few weeks, the numbers have shifted because of a Likud political ad that has been characterized as both stupid and offensive. Criticism by Meir Dagan, a former director of Mossad, that Netanyahu's policies regarding the conflict with the Palestinians would turn Israel into a binational state, and a leaked document alleging that the prime minister had agreed in principle to return to the 1967 lines in a deal with the Palestinians, something that he has said that he would never do. On the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, thousands returned to Selma, Alabama, to remember and reflect on the civil rights movement. In 1965, 600 Jewish men and women were among those who went to the South to help register voters. There was a gathering at Congregation Mishkan Israel, which is just a few blocks from the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, during the commemoration of the famous march that started peacefully and ended with the violence of billy clubs and tear gas. Among the speakers were David Goodman, the brother of Andrew Goodman, who along with James Cheney and Michael Schwerner were killed in Mississippi, and Susanna Heschel, noted scholar and the daughter of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, and the new director of the Religious Action Center for Reform Judaism, Rabbi Jonah Pesner. Thoughts were shared about those civil rights issues which remain to this day: immigrant rights, LGBT rights, economic inequality, and voting rights. This is Rabbi Batsheva Appel, and that was the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Macy Hart, the president, CEO, and inspirational spirit of the Goldring Woldenberg Institute of Southern Jewish Life, which promotes Judaism, Jewish education through a variety of highly innovative programs and resources. And I want to ask about that. Macy, the Encyclopedia of Southern Jewish Communities is an extraordinary online resource. It shows really virtually every Southern Jewish community and who was there and how they got started. I have a bone to pick with you. I was in Spartanburg, South Carolina for 4 years, and I'm not mentioned in our biography there. I'm very disappointed. I just wanted to share that with you.
Because of your influence.
Yes, I was clearly so incredibly important. I should have superseded the 100-and-some years of history before that.
That will be changed, I assure you, Rabbi.
Thank you. This encyclopedia is an incredible resource. How is it assembled? How does it get maintained?
One of the departments of the Institute is the History Department, Jewish Life in America. is very full of wonderful stories and obviously perseverance. And so we have a PhD historian, and the idea originally, just to show you my age and my lack of technological savvy, was to have filing cabinets for each state. In each state's filing cabinet, sort of metaphorical, one drawer would be the cemeteries, one drawer would be the synagogues, one drawer would be the business community, one drawer would be the, you know, the heroes and the Jewish folks who worked hard to change the communities they lived in. And with the coming of the real technological age and young staff, we decided to go virtual. And our historian at that time, Dr. Stuart Rockoff, who spent 11 years with us, started putting it together. And with interns and research trips, we had several grants along the way. So it took about, 6 or 7 years to get that all up and running online, one state at a time. We still have the Panhandle and Central Florida to go before we're done with the 13 states that we deal with.
It's an amazing resource, but it's really just the tip of the iceberg. You have a rabbinic department that you have a full-time rabbi on staff. I don't know how often that's happened there, but you visit many communities that don't have a full-time rabbi, don't really have a rabbi coming at all. Can you tell us a little bit about how many such communities there are? What's the situation now in the South?
Well, the situation in the South, I just need to put a plug in for possibly your listeners. The situation in the South is a national issue. We chose to do the area that I knew. I'm from this part of the world, and for my 30 years as the camp director in this territory, we just expanded it because the story in Texas is the same story as in South Carolina, but truthfully, it's the same story in North and South Dakota and Oregon and D.C. and
Montana and
to New England.
Around.
Yeah, right. every place. And we have maps that show that, but we decided to make it a model for what could be done in other parts of the country. So we have an itinerant rabbi on our staff. We actually have one full-time rabbi doing that, and we borrow 20% of the full-time rabbi, who is the assistant director of our education department. We borrow 20% of his time, so we have 1 1/5 full-time rabbis. And as you and I had discussed prior, we're going to be recruiting you as quickly as we can to give us a weekend, a year or more, if you want, to go and serve congregations that don't have full-time rabbis. Now, some congregations that don't have full-time rabbis, there's a whole big set of issues. Some has to do with economics. Some have to do with demographics of what the ordination groups, the newly ordained rabbis or the rabbis who are shifting from one job to another, that eliminate themselves from serving in non-urban areas, which also then limits the opportunities for some of these congregations who actually could afford to have a rabbi. Some congregations have student pulpits, which is a once a month or it could be biweekly. And these are rabbinic students training. And I can assure you, and I'll bet you that you have a similar experience, that if you served one of these congregations, and probably served 2 or 3 in your rabbinic matriculation, you would have been touched by the experience of how these communities have struggled to stay a vibrant Jewish community, even as their numbers diminish.
Powerfully.
So that was our goal.
Sure, that's a powerful experience. I served Pine Bluff, Arkansas, in your region, and Billings, Montana, and I can tell you it's an extraordinary experience. You, as a rabbinic student and a intern rabbi, you gain more than you give, there's no doubt. You have also found a way, educationally, to serve communities where there may be 20 kids in the school spread out in a broad range. There might be one kid in a region because of the concentrations now in the bigger cities. Come up with a very innovative distance learning experience. Can you talk about that a little bit in your education department?
Well, I would love to talk about that, because what we believe here at the Institute is that every child deserves access to a Jewish education. I have to throw in a little bit of editorial if I am permitted, and you haven't told me to stop yet, so I will. In America, the secular world, whether the school system is public or private, has to get kids ready for college through a college entrance exam known as a college prep curriculum. Those who chose vocational would have had a vocational tech-type curriculum all through school, but they still had to have a math, science, English, and history. Now, of all the values that many Jews have, consensus is that at least two for most every Jewish family is that their kids get a good education so they can get into a good school. And the other is so they can get a good Jewish education. And yet what America created because of some, I really have never been able to articulate it as well as I would really like to, but we decided to create every synagogue as an independent, separate school system. Well, in communities that don't have Jewish professionals and rely on well-meaning volunteers and teachers like my mom and dad, who are merchants, great merchants, but had no idea about curriculum or how to write it, still had the same responsibility to try to educate the four unmotivated Jewish children of the Hart family in Winona, Mississippi. They had the same responsibility. And yet our national organizations do not work toward that. And so what we did is we created a secular world approach to Jewish education. So in the same way that rural teachers in isolated communities teach children in the secular world how to count in the first grade that leads to adding in the second, subtracting, multiply, all the way through to the higher math and obviously a college entrance exam, we have always provided, we the Jewish community, for ourselves, and yet we don't have an educational system that ensured, and our smallest school has one student across the 13 states, right, but they have access to a quality Jewish education. So what we did is we created the secular world approach, put a group of educators from across movements, graduate students, specialists in particular areas of age appropriateness, and they had a mandate of come up with a common body of Jewish knowledge where we can agree on at minimum what we want every Jewish first grader to know before they go to the second, and spiral it all the way up through high school. And that was done over a year, and it was a very dynamic conversation because my requirement was no halakhic editorial comment, because I didn't want any movement to lose its own practice or embrace of theology. But I wanted the kids to be able to have opportunity for a good Jewish education. So we created a Jewish Teach for America, if I can just borrow that. And we were doing that before there was a post-birthright, but it is an absolute example of post-birthright, is that we take these post-college two-year, we created these two-year fellowships under the supervision of two master educators, and we deliver the curriculum to the communities that partner with us. The curriculum is 5,000 pages. It is scripted lesson plan by lesson plan by lesson plan so that my merchant parents could actually teach, because they have a fellow assigned. Each fellow has from 6 to 8 congregations, Reform, Conservative, far away from the office, close to the office, with professionals, without professionals. When they go into these communities, they lead services. If it's a congregation without a professional and it's been lay-led, then we lead their service. We don't bring our package service. So our young people are well-trained. And so we started with two of these fellows in 4 states. And as we were able to raise dollars, we expanded into our full 13-state area. Now we have 9 of these educational fellows under the two master educators, and we have 34 former fellows And we've created a map to show where they live today and the number that are rabbis, educators that have been touched by this program. So we believe that the children deserve this access to education. If we could find ways to break down the impenetrable walls among congregations, in my example, Rabbi, would be that an educator in one community that has multiple synagogues who's really good with elementary and not so good with teens, and across town somebody's really good with teens and not so good with elementary, they're never working together on any sort of common curriculum because each one of them is a separate school entity like the secular worlds. So we decided we wanted to break the mold. This whole organization was designed to be a model for what could be replicated in other communities. So the final two or three things I'll mention about this is there are now close to 3,000 kids across 13 states, Reform, conservative, unaffiliated, whose religious schools are partnering with us, who are on the same basic page, week after week after week. And if a professional in a community that partners with us thinks that one of our 10 core pieces is too heavy, they can lighten it. If they think it's too light, they can make it heavier. But if it's a lay group, which our Jewish community has slammed over so many decades about the poor teachers, the poor teacher quality, but we never did anything
to improve that quality, right?
Right, or just to help them. So our fellows work with those folks, and it's really an unbelievable experience. And our belief is that these kids have access to Jewish education. So when you come visit us, and let's say we have to run to a store to because you forgot your luggage and we have to buy you a suit or something, you're going to support the public school system of this town when you pay tax. And back to the we all have always, as a Jewish community, taken care of our own. But when you look at the congregational setup on a normal basis, if a member of the congregation has a life cycle event, wedding, funeral, bris, naming, bar bat mitzvah, or other nice simchas, there's no charge for the rabbinic service because that's a product and a privilege of membership.
Right.
But when it comes to the school, there's a tuition. And if there's a shortage in the budget, the people who are assessed, for the most part, this is a generalized statement, but for most part, from my experience, the families that are assessed are the end users. But if we look at those families, that's where probably both people are working in the couple, and they have very little discretionary dollars. And people like me, whose children are long out of that school, when we were very young and really probably couldn't afford a lot of those things, other people were making it happen. Why are we looking at it that way? So our cost for our curriculum, and we have over $5 million invested so far, is $800 flat fee, and that covers the three visits, the full curriculum, and the on the phone on a weekly basis with as much support as a community could use, and then $36 a student. So we have at least a $400,000 deficit before we open the door because we are committed to access to Jewish education from our communities. And they have to put that part in. So we pay 85% or 85 cents on the dollar. Because how do we want kids to get where they're going? Do we want them to say, come find me? Or do we want to say, where do I sign up? I want to be a part of arts and culture and Jewish education. So I'm sorry I talked so long, but it's a very deep subject, and there's so much more to talk about.
I feel that in many ways we just scratched the surface, but if you want to find out more about the Institute of Southern Jewish Life, you can go to their website. That is isjl.org, is that correct?
That's correct.
And it's an incredible website, great resource, not only on Jews of the South, but as you've heard, on doing Jewish education, making it accessible for everyone, and that's just a little bit of all of the tremendous work. Macy, thanks for all the great work you do, and continued success, and we look forward to talking to you again sometime soon.
Thanks a lot. Nice to talk to you, too.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Tucson City Councilman and former Vice Mayor Paul Cunningham, discussing his Jewish roots and his life, and also talking about overcoming his personal challenge with addiction. It will be fascinating and compelling. Our playout this morning comes from one of our more eclectic CDs of Passover music, with Pesach coming up in just a couple of weeks, beginning on the evening of April 3rd. This is from the Reggae Passover recording. It's their version of the old spiritual Go Down Moses. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
When Israel was in Egypt land.